All right, here it is, February 26th. We're going to discuss Revelations of Joseph Smith III. And I wanted to start off with just saying that I am really impressed with Joseph Smith III and his prophetic understanding and insight. I'll just show you, these are my reference materials. One was the memoirs of Joseph Smith III, and the other is a biography of Joseph Smith III called he's called the Pragmatic Prophet. Now, I think that he goes a little bit too much on that, and I'll discuss it here in a minute, but so let's go ahead and get started here. So Joseph Smith III, he's born in Kirtland, Ohio in 1832 and died in Independence in 1914. He lived to 82, which is a long life, and he did a great work. He was only 11 years old when his father died. And after the church, after that point, and saints moved west and everything, there were people that gathered together to form the RLDS Church. And they came to Joseph Smith III and says, "Will you lead us?" And he says, "No, I won't do it until I feel directed to." And so by 1860, he felt directed. So he had three wives. The first wife, he had five children. Two of them died young. Second wife, he had nine children. Four of them died young. And the third wife, he had three children. And so through that process, he had three sons that followed him as president of the church. Frederick Madison from the second wife, and Israel A. Smith from the second wife, and then Wallace Smith from the third wife. I'm going to turn off my video. So, and you can see that the first wife, she had a son, but he died young. So she didn't have any sons that could have been a president of the church. And Bertha, as we say, provided two sons, Frederick Madison and Israel Alexander. And then Ada Clark, the last one. I just want to make one more comment. The second wife was actually there helping with the care of the first wife until she died. And so it was an easy transition for her to be the second wife. And then the last one was more from outside of the relationships there. But anyway, the Latter-day Saints, and I need to let someone else read this. Michael, you want to read this page?
Yeah, I can read it. The Latter-day Saints repeatedly visited Joseph Smith III and asked him to take up his father's mantle. But his reply was that he would only assume the church presidency if he were inspired by God to do so. Mm-hmm. Finally, in 1860, Smith said that he had received this inspiration, and at a conference in Amboy, Illinois on April 6, 1860, he was sustained as president of the RLDS Church. That's exactly 30 years later from when his father organized, looks like. The original church. Okay.
Yes, interesting.
Smith received the final answer for which he had hungered in the fall of 1859. In an 1880 autobiography, Joseph Smith reported that while praying for an explanation of his troubles, he received a divine message that the saints reorganized.
I want to pause right there. He felt almost like Job during that 1859 time period. Go ahead.
He received an explanation of his troubles. He received a divine message that the saints reorganized Zarahemla and other places is the only organized portion of the church accepted by me. I have given them my spirit and will continue to do so while they remain humble and faithful. Joseph Smith, Pragmatic Prophet. Joseph Smith III stated at the 1860 conference, "I would say to you, brethren, as I hope you may be, and in faith I trust that you are, as a people that God has promised his blessing upon, I came not here of myself, but by the influence of the Spirit. For some time past, I have received manifestations pointing to the positions which I am about to assume. I wish to say that I have come here not to be dictated by any men or set of men. I have come in obedience to a power not my own, and shall be dictated by the power that sent me. God works by means best known to himself, and I feel that for some time past, he has been pointing out a work for me to do." And then next page, does it end there?
Yeah, that ends there.
Okay.
For me to do. Any comments? All right. Bill, would you like to read this next page?
I was going to ask, how old was he when he became the prophet in 1860?
27.
27. Okay. All right. Cool.
About the same age as his father.
Joseph Smith. Yeah.
Yeah.
In 18- A lot of parallels here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Bill.
I could read it.
Yeah, it's a little, the text is a little small for me.
Well, hold on. Let me blow it up. Is that better?
Yeah, it's a little better. Yeah. Joseph Smith III. Yep, perfect. Thanks, Russell. Joseph Smith III has been called a pragmatic prophet. We need to be careful as we read from his biography by Roger D. Luminous. With problems of all types, he carefully considered all manifestations and took action that could be considered compromises in all too many instances. He was, in the best tradition of American philosophy, a pragmatist. He preferred to see changes come slowly after due deliberation and with the consent of all affected groups. Almost instinctively, Smith inclined to a middle-of-the-road position on issues. Such a leader was critical to the continued success of what had begun as a loosely organized, extremely heterogeneous movement started by a strikingly non-conformist dissenters of the early church. And there's a site there. I believe we can acknowledge all of the personal skills that Joseph Smith III had, but we must also realize that he was an actual prophet of God and that his success was through the process of listening to God. We have to acknowledge and recognize God's influence in his life and that he was willing to wait on the Lord for guidance and direction.
I think that is so important that he really was. And I think it's evident as his sons tried to take control after him, that they didn't listen quite so well. And I don't know. Do you have any, maybe Jazz and others have other comments related to their have more experience on this?
So you're saying, Russell, I just want to
go over.
You're saying that he was perhaps pragmatic, but he was also just really leaning on God, and that made him more pragmatic.
Exactly. I mean, it appears that he was pragmatic, but really he was leaning on God, and so the appearance, it wasn't him alone that made it look that way.
Okay, gotcha. Thanks.
Let's see, Daz, do you want to read this next part?
Yeah, sure. Yep. In the 1850s, the reorganization had functioned under a very loose organizational structure, almost a confederacy of virtually independent congregations that could choose to accept the policies of the General Church Conference and the quorum of the 12 apostles, or ignore them completely without fear of punishment. As a consequence, the church had been unable to sustain any extended missionary work or forceful policy because of the shifting nature of support from the members. When Joseph Smith III assumed the presidency of the reorganized church in 1860, he was an inexperienced young man, not yet 28 years old, who did not understand the intricacies of either the centralized operation of the church under his father, of the rather loosely organized confederation within the reorganization. He quickly realized that the reorganized church had to reinstitute some form of central direction, come to some understanding of basic doctrine and work toward the enforcement of orthodoxy if it were to ever to grow into anything more than a small faction filled with individualists and cranks. Centralization of the church's administration took several years of numerous small steps before Smith could begin to claim real authority over the movement. Joseph Smith, the third pragmatic prophet. One of Joseph's first revelations was in 1861 when he was trying to decide if he should enlist to fight in the Civil War. Other religious leaders in the North felt no hesitation about supporting the war effort, both morally and materially, and Smith could easily have taken this approach. Unable to decide what he should do, Smith decided to pray for direction from God. He specifically asked about the propriety of serving in the military, and after weeks of contemplation, received an answer that he said was clear, definite, and unmistakable. Do not enlist. Enlisting makes your military service an individual of voluntary action, whereby you might shed blood while in the service. Wait. If drafted, the responsibility is lifted. In such case, do not hesitate to take your places in the ranks and to do your full duty as good soldiers and citizens supporting the government to the best of your powers. Okay, Joseph Smith, the third pragmatic prophet, page 135, yeah.
I think that's a very interesting revelation. Yeah. And then one of these first.
Yeah. I'll just make a comment, just a quick comment. Some of you guys won't have this. This is a very rare document we have. And it was used by the missionaries very early here in Australia. But it's Joseph Smith III at a court case about the temple law. And he describes what happened during his father's death and how he became the president of the church. And it's too much to read, but that's the book there. And you can see all the little pages in there underlined, the important stuff.
This was a
missionary book. Yeah. And you guys would find it so interesting to hear from his actual lips at the court case what was going on, when he was ordained, who he was ordained by, and how the church got set up. So maybe I can scan that and send it on an email or something at some stage. That'd be good.
Anyway. But very interesting to see this. And
it's sort of going over the stuff that we're reading right now. It's
from the early Doctrine and Covenants I have here, section 114. It was given on October the 7th, 1861. And
now we will get to 114 in the course of this lesson.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, okay. I won't comment any more on that at this stage. Thanks, Brother Russell. Good.
Thanks, Russell.
In fact, we're going to go through all the sections, which maybe is too much, but that's our plan.
Yeah.
Okay. Darla, would you like to read this next page? And you notice here I put the Joseph Smith III's words in green or in this blue. So when they appear later on, you'll see those. Then they come from the memoirs.
Joseph Smith III revelation, the S sections. In October 1860, a committee was organized to nominate four men to fill out the quorum of the 12, but they only nominated three. Then in April 1861, they changed the minutes of 1860 to read the quorum of the 12 should be filled as far as practicable. This was a little disappointing. The question as of to the rights and privileges and duties resting upon the church by virtue of what is known as the law of tithing has been brought into prominence and serious and earnestly discussed. While pondering over the matter after an earnest engagement in such prayer, I became aware of a power being exercised over me such I had never felt before experienced. and vividly impressed upon my consciousness came that which embodied in the revelation mentioned. It will be noticed that the commission also includes a warning against self-aggrandizement, closing with the words of whomsoever he may be. There had grown up in the minds of those whom the reorganization movement began a strong active repugnance to the idea of what was called a one-man rule of power or power. Section 114, October 7th, 1861, the 12 are able to work in the bishop in executing the law of tithing. 1b, and let them before God see to it that the temporal means so obtained is truly used for the purposes of the church and is not as a weapon of power in the hands of one man for the oppression of the others or for the purposes of self-aggrandizement by anyone, be he whosoever he may be. 2, as I live, saith the Lord, in the manner ye execute this matter, so shall ye be judged in the day of judgment.
Okay, you'll notice that I only brought out a little bit of the revelations. This becomes more evident. Sometimes I miss a lot of verses. This revelation only had 3 verses. I brought out 2. But go ahead. You had a comment on 114, I think. Was it Daz or?
Yeah.
Okay. No, it was only just of interest there because of this being the first revelation given as prophet and seer of the church at that time. You can see all the way through, and I felt that he was a very humble man, and certainly he was respected by not only the church folk at the time, but also those within the community, because I read the detail of that the things that happened when he passed away and the eulogy that was given by not only church folk, but also by those of the community. And obviously, as I said, a lot of respect because of his humility. And that humility may have been seen perhaps in a different light because it was a different time to what we experience. And you know, when we view people with reflection on what they achieved, I guess it was also very difficult to pick up the reins of his father at that time because, you know, you would be expected to exactly walk in the same footsteps as Joseph Smith Jr. walked in, but he was his own personality and the criticisms of some of his ways in which he did his leadership, to me only would have been perhaps what I would have done or maybe what you would have done when you were seeking the Lord's guidance and direction in that role. But this section that I've got here in 114, if you like, can I read the just the general introduction to this? It's only just a few verses. It says, this section is an appendix. This is 114, added by Joseph Smith III to the first general epistle of the Council of 12 to all the saints. The appendix was in the nature of a revelation from God given through the prophet and seer of the church on October the 7th, 1861. It was affirmed by the General Conference of September 1871, 10 years later. And was ordered by the General Conference of 1878 to be printed in future editions of the Doctrine and Covenants. This is the first revelation given to the church through Joseph Smith III. This section should be read with the above-mentioned epistle of the Council of 12 as published in Church History, Volume 3, page 298, and in the True Latter-day Saints Herald, Volume 2, pages 155 to 157, for the interpretation read also, paragraph 5 of section 122. So that was just the preamble and some little detail of that particular revelation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bakia, would you like to read this next page?
Yep. It's from section 150.
Yeah, where it starts about as no revelation has been received.
Oh. As no revelation had been received by the reorganized church up to 1863, directing the filling of the first quorum, first presidency, many questions arose. After the expiration of 3 years from the time I was chosen to preside, it seemed a favorable and opportune time for the Lord to direct in the matter. Thus, at the conference of 1863, a revelation was received, directing the church to call and ordain William Marx to be a counselor to the president of the church. Want me to go on?
Yes.
Section 115, March 1863. William Marx is called to be the first presidency. Elders are to travel two by two to preach the gospel. It is my will that you ordain and set apart my servant William Marx to be a counselor to my servant Joseph, even the president of my church, that the first presidency of my church may be more perfectly filled. In elevating the appointment to the level of a formal revelation written for the church, Smith accomplished two purposes. As God's prophet, I cannot read any further. As God's prophet, he nominated the person to hold the office, and he virtually assured that his recommendation would be accepted by the church body.
I might just mention that here we are 3 years later, and we still don't have a full first presidency. In fact, I think it was 27 years that it didn't have the full quorum of the 12. It was an interesting process that Joseph Smith III was allowed himself to, proceed along the plan as God would outline. And I think this is only one more member of the first presidency. He still didn't have a second counselor. And I'm not sure how long others might have better answer on that, but. Any other comments?
I would just point out that William Marx was stake president in Nauvoo at the death of Joseph, I believe.
That's right. And in the revelations, the high council is really a much higher level than was later acknowledged, where the 12 kind of took control. The high council really had a very high position in section 107 of Utah DNC. Okay, this is an interesting one. Maybe I'll read this. At the conference of 1865, considerable discussion was had upon the proposition of ordaining Negroes. After much discussion, it was resolved that we refer the above matter to the Lord, and then come together fasting and praying to God that he will reveal his will on this point unto his servant Joseph Smith. So in this section, this was after the Civil War, men of every nation will be ordained to the priesthood admonitions to the priesthood. So 1b, lo, it is my will that my gospel shall be preached to all nations in every land, and that men of every tongue, shall minister before me. Therefore, it is expedient in me that you ordain priests unto me of every race to receive the teachings of my law and become heirs according to the promise. And then later, be not hasty in ordaining men of the Negro race to offices in my church, for verily I say unto you, all are not acceptable unto me as servants. Nevertheless, I will that all may be saved, but every man in his own order, and there are some who are chosen instruments to be ministers to their own race. Be ye content, I, the Lord, have spoken it. And then John Pratt gives us these few words I think are really interesting. Just think of how much grief and heartache could have been avoided if this revelation from the Lord had been known to, or perhaps even been received by the LDS Church. The church could have been a leader in giving equality rather than having been one of the last holdouts. In fact, many observers, both within the church and outside, believe that the LDS Church had finally simply caved into the pressure from demonstrations and the media. It was not good press for the church. Note also the differences between this revelation and that received by the LDS leaders in 1978. LDS President Kimball held a meeting with the apostles where each presented his view on the subject. All agreed that the time had come for all worthy men to receive the priesthood. Then they all prayed for a confirmation of heaven of their decision. All testified that they felt a powerful witness from the Holy Ghost. A declaration was later added to the LDS DNC stating that President Kimball had received revelation, but the witness of the apostles only testified of a strong confirmation of their decision. In other words, no revelation was added to the DNC, but only a declaration that one had been received. Any comments? Lynn, did you have a comment? I see your lips moving, but I don't hear anything.
I love this, Russell. This is great. It's interesting because it says there that all are not acceptable or be not hasty. And I'm wondering if that has to do with, I don't know, in the Sealed Book of Mormon, it talks a little bit about slaves and set them free if it's in their mind to be free. But allow them to continue serving if that's within their mind. So I guess kind of that same thing, you know, don't just ordain everyone, but be prayerful about it.
Very good. So yeah, I think that's, you know, a really interesting, and of course, you know, this is a revelation that was given early enough for the LDS to have recognized them, but of course they're not going to recognize anything from the RLDS. Darla, would you like to?
I was just going to say it took us 113 years after this. You know, if we would have just recognized that revelation as coming from God, like John said, we could have saved us so much grief.
Yes, exactly.
Indeed, because Joseph Smith ordained the first black man. Actually, I have his name in some notes, but not in front of me. And I also have in my notes William Marks that Joseph Smith discussed, I believe, garments and polygamy with William Marks and had some interesting comments back when he was alive.
Yep.
So it's fun that he's a part of the apostleship and presidency with Joseph Smith III.
Yeah, Elijah Abel was the name of that first one.
Thank you for your memory.
Okay, Darla, would you like to read this part?
Of course. By 1873, prompted by the dissemination of the general officers through death, affirmity, registration, or defection, Smith had decided that the time had come to organize the leading quorums of the church. Smith was operating alone in the presidency. Rogers was operating alone in the presiding bishopric. And less than half of the apostles were functioning. In addition, the Quorum of the 70 had been virtually destroyed as an effective missionary tool. In the spring of 1873, proved to be an eventful one. Through many periods of prayer, which characterized the entire year before the sitting of the conference, the necessities of the church were presented to God. And in response, he granted a revelation through which a more perfect organization was secured. I felt I could not continue to give revelations to the church unless there should be established a better organization of the quorums under whose administration such revelations should be presented should reach the body. In the days of the following, the 1873 revelation, reception, I was permitted to enjoy the presence of the Spirit in a remarkable degree. There had developed among the brethren, as I have said, something in the nature of a strife over the question as to who is authorized to formulate the doctrine and the theories of the church. And upon the part of a few, there seemed desire to be the ones to direct in this regard. The provisions of the revelation seemed to throw about us in a definite and much desired safeguard. The specific mentioned in this revelation of elders J.W. Briggs, Josiah Ellis, and E.C. Briggs to remain as special witnesses indicate that having been members of the church, they were still to be reorganized as standing in their proper callings by the spirit of the master regarded as strong, valiant, and useful men. The men newly chosen were wise young men who had approved themselves in the field as able and worthy expounders of the faith, well qualified to be called to succeed such men as those who had been taken from the quorum by death. Their choice seemed to prove conclusively that the spirit of supervision, which had been over the body from the first, still continued.
Okay, so that's an introduction to this section 117. Where the first presidency was filled for the first time since the church was organized in 1860. So here we got 13 years without a full first presidency. W.W. Blair and David W. Smith are called to the presidency. Several are called to the Quorum of the 12. The bishop has chosen to choose counselors and bishop agents, the contingent sees. Now, David H. Smith is Joseph Smith III's brother. And he was an interesting man. He wrote a lot of beautiful hymns and poems, so forth. And he didn't, his life ended up in a sanitarium. He had some health problems that just never resolved themselves. Interesting life story. So I'll just read it. Until such time as the Quorum of the 12 shall be filled, the decision of that quorum, a unanimous decision, shall be accounted final as if such quorum were filled, according to my law as given in the Book of Doctrine and Covenants. And until such time as the quorum of the 70 shall be filled, their decision, if unanimous and agreeing with that of the quorum of the 12, shall be considered the same as if the quorum were filled. That contentions and quarrelings among you cease, sustain each other in peace, and ye shall be blessed with my spirit in comforting and strengthening for you for my work.
Just a comment there that all through the years, I had not known of a David H. Smith, brother of Joseph Smith III. So that was just interesting to me to know his outcome, which was not, and possibly because of that, it was sort of never sort of spoken of. I certainly wasn't aware of it. Okay, well, thank you.
And the claim by the LDS people is that David Smith went on a mission to Utah, and they claim that he was converted to Brigham's claims and that he lost the faith. And that's why his brother Schultz shoved him off into a sanitarium. That's actually not true at all, but that's the story that goes around. So yeah, he was a wonderful man, and I'd like to know more about him. I've looked at some of his hymns, and they're beautiful. Yeah, all right, you bet. Bill, would you like to read this next one?
Yes. Some 9 years elapsed, 1882, before the next revelation was received, during which time some uneasiness concerning the still uncompleted quorum had again developed. There arose also the question as to whether or not the reorganized church was authorized or expected to occupy the grounds of foreign missionary work which had been open during the days of Joseph and Hiram Smith. The fall conference in 1882 was held in Lamoni, and it was at that time I had, in the experience of my presiding authority, to pass through the most severe trial I had yet encountered. Indeed, it was the most serious situation in which I had been called to act, for I stood face to face against two of the most prominent and leading members of the ministry as they openly defied me and my decisions. I commended the reading of the Revelation of 1882 for the spirit it breathes, as well as for the law it expounds. I establish more securely the grounds of our contention against evil. Do you want me to read on there, Russell?
Yeah, go ahead.
Section 118, September 28th, 1882, 8 verses. Need for further organization of unity, heed the counsel of the traveling ministry. It is my will that ye more fully honor and pay heed to the voice and counsel of the traveling ministry in spiritual things, which if ye do not, the office which they hold is not honored in my service, and the good they should do is made void. If they approve themselves as religious ministers, they shall be blessed. If they be found transgressors or idle servants, ye shall not uphold them. But be not hasty in withdrawing your support from them. Preadventure they shall injure my work. Ye shall injure my work. Even now, one moment. Justin! I got my little autistic kid coming in. Even now, I am not well pleased with some. But space is granted for repentance and a renewal of diligence. Let no one deceive himself that he shall not account for his stewardship unto me.
Okay. I might ask what you think as far as time. How long do you want to go?
This is so interesting. I'd say we could do one more, but
sure.
What do you guys think?
I'm not in a hurry. This is very interesting. I have really no experience with this stuff.
Yeah. Let's do another section.
Yeah.
I can read it too if you want me to.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Okay. Some more of less agitated questions were decided by the revelation, which particular officers of the church were qualified by their calling to administer the bread and the wine, the time for the observance of the sacrament, the fixing of the first day of the week, commonly called the Lord's Day, as the Sabbath, the admonition to the official members of the church calling for a greater degree of sobriety and diligence on their part, and the endorsement of the song service with a general change to the whole membership to cultivate music. The voice of the Spirit came to me in such plain and unmistakable terms that it was no wonder the revelation was promptly and unanimously accepted for the government and guidance of the church.
Yeah, John Pratt has several comments on this one, so this is a good one for us to end on.
Okay, awesome. Section 119, April 11th, 1887. Elders are to be of sober mind, studious, humble, sincere, and set a good example instructions concerning the sacrament, service of song, keeping the Sabbath, prosecuting the missionary work, and care of the mind and body. 3C, men of God who bear the vessels of the Lord, be ye clean in your bodies and in your clothing. Let your garments be of a sober character and free from excess of ornamentation. Avoid the use of tobacco and be not addicted to strong drink in any form, that your counsel to be temperate may be made effectual by your example. And the Spirit saith further, contention is unseemly. Therefore, cease to contend respecting the sacrament and the time of administering it. For whether it be upon the first Lord's Day of every month or upon the Lord's Day of every week, if it be administered by the officers of the church with sincerity of heart and in purity of purpose, and be partaken of in remembrance of Jesus Christ and in willingness to take upon them his name by them who partake. It is acceptable to God.
Okay. I'm going to read this next page.
Okay.
Here are some salient items covered in section 119 from John Pratt. As late as 1887, 27 years after the founding of the church, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles was not complete, but each member had been named in a revelation. Elders should have goodly speech, sober clothing, and be a good example to win souls. Don't be eager to court apostates to return. They might well bring heresies. Some who have left the church will return if not hindered by elders. The sacrament of the Lord's Day can be weekly or monthly. The emblems of the sacrament are referred to as bread and wine. The breaking of bread and pouring of wine can be before or after the prayers, early in the meeting. Church hymns should not sound like funeral dirges. Reed, string, and brass instruments are allowed with the wisdom in sacrament meetings, but not during prayers or testimonies. Hymn books should be provided. The church should meet on the Lord's Day, considered to be the first day of the week, as the day of worship, and rest until further revelation be given. The Lord's Day should be kept with wisdom, not wasting anything or judging those doing necessary work. All are called to missionary work using their particular gifts. Sleep at night as designed by God, which can prevent suffering in mind and body. Be cheerful, even with bodily suffering, which is not relieved by blessing or wisdom. Comments?
Go ahead.
What does the last mean? Be cheerful even with bodily sufferings, which is not relieved by blessings or wisdom.
So they may get a blessing to be healed and it doesn't get healed, but be cheerful.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'd just like to comment on that revelation on verse 7, I think it's A and B, about the changing of the Lord's Day to the Sunday when they did that. That's a big thing that happened in the RLDS Church, because at the time they were under a lot of pressure from the new members that were coming into the church. That we're used to calling the Holy Day the Sunday from the Catholic Church, obviously from the Catholic Church and those churches that were observing that. And to this day, the people that we are still in contact with still believe that this revelation stands fast, that they're not to change that. And that's some of the problems we've had in converting anybody to come and listen about the seal book because of this. And they say, no, it says in Revelation that this is to be kept on the Sunday until further revelation. And we say, well, the seal books now come out with that noting that we are to keep the seventh day. And this is the fight we've had. And I had a heated discussion online with someone about this, and they held fast to it. They said this 119 stands fast until we get a revelation. So I just thought I'd share that to you. It's still going on to this day.
Well, but the thing that John Pratt brought out is the fact that the Sabbath is from noon Saturday to noon Sunday, and so you get to fulfill both people's requirements.
Yeah, that's correct. But they don't recognize the seventh day. They say it's the first day of the week is what they're saying.
Because of their tradition.
Because of their tradition. Yeah, basically. Yeah. So they will not respect anything on the Saturday at all. Yeah.
Not at this stage.
Yeah, not at this stage, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate all your comments and everything. I think we're going to stop our recording.